That's my opening. Yeah. Pretend that wasn't lame. Incredibly lame.
You're listening to the Gaming Asylum Podcast.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode. What is this? Five? Yeah, it's five.
It is in fact five. I believe.
I don't care.
Episode five of the Gaming Asylum Podcast. We're your hosts. I'm Michael.
I'm Jeff.
And I'm, you know, the curmudgeon.
That's Mark, the self-proclaimed curmudgeon. And we're kind of running short on time here, so just in case this episode's a little shorter than usual, so let's just go straight into what we're playing. Jeff, what are you playing?
I have just managed to finish Fable 3 and Bioshock 1. I had Bioshock 1 at this perpetual state of about 30% and finally said, I got a Christmas present of Bioshock 2, I better finish it. So I plowed all the way through, loved the story, very good. I am now maybe like 10% into Bioshock 2. I really like the fact that, you know, literally, you know, finishing Bioshock 1, popping the second CD right in, all of the experience seems to be the same, except for the hacking, which I can respect why they changed it, but it was the only thing they get, hey, this isn't the hacking I remember, I like Pipe Mania. But, and then for pen and paper RPGs, still playing my D&D campaign, or at least still trying to, because one of the players won't show up. And then for board games, the weather in St. Louis has been very, very not good. So I actually have not been to a real board game meetup in like a week and a half. So coming soon. Anyway, Mike, what have you been playing?
In terms of video games, I've been playing a lot of Dead Rising 2, which is incredibly fun and ridiculous and makes no sense whatsoever. Just the synopsis of the game in one sentence. You can take a battery and attach it to a wheelchair and make an electric chair that you ride around. Then you attach guns to that, and somehow by adding guns, the wiring changes so you can ride around on a motorized wheelchair with guns mowing down zombies. And it is the most fantastic thing ever invented by anyone ever.
Do you do all that with duct tape?
Yes.
Cool.
Somehow. And then I've also been playing a lot of Street Fighter 4 and slowly making my way out of Suckstown and into Mediocrityville.
Okay.
I can actually pull off some super moves, and I win one out of every maybe five or six online matches, which I can live with. And in terms of pen and paper, I've been doing nothing, because my group is currently split up, plus I've been kind of stuck in my house the last couple days due to ice. Although I've... And also laziness. Mostly laziness.
How bad is the ice in the Texas area?
It was worse Tuesday. It was the worst Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday because whatchamacallit? It was just ice then. I mean, the roads were slippery and everything was all crazy lameness. And then Friday, yesterday, and today is snow, and the snow is almost gone as of today. So I'm gonna miss no more school.
I think it was yesterday. On the drive home from running errands, just as I was getting ready to pull back into the apartment complex, a sheet of ice broke off the actual roof of my car and slid onto the trunk. I went to the trunk after I got parked the car, broke off part of it, and you guys know those industrial-sized chocolate bar fragments that sometimes some stores carry for you shave it down and you melt it and you cook with chocolate, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
There was a solid inch of weighty, snow-packed ice on the hood of my car, on the top of my car, which meant when I had originally cleaned it off a day or two ago, that had been all over the car.
Crazy.
It was that consistency and that size.
Wow.
So, Mark, gaming recently, what have you been doing?
I have been playing Yo-Kai Buster Ruka no Daiboken. And then the other day, I was playing some Tobi Daisei Daisakusen, and its sequel, JJ.
Are you just name-dropping big Japanese names to sound impressive and indie?
No, those were actual games I was playing. Yo-Kai Buster Ruka is on the SNES, and Tobi Daisei Daisakusen was on the NES.
If you want those in the show notes, you're going to need to type those up for me, because I'm not even going to try.
No.
If you don't, I'm just going to label them Dave and Larry.
Okay,
Dave and Larry. I am vaguely curious suddenly to realize... Yeah. Does the Japanese game dev market have an indie market, or is it all, like, small anyway? Small studios?
Back in the day, for Japanese game development, it was all a bunch of very tiny studios. That's how you got games like Mindseeker, which was actually programmed by a very famous psychic and a small rock band. But nowadays, it's all the very large companies, Nintendo, Capcom, Konami, etc., etc.
All right. Though that one company game does sound like Buckaroo Banzai 2.
Though, and you know what? Tobirai Daisakusen did come out over here called 3D World Runner, one of Square Enix's first games, or just Square.
Wait, 3D World Runner?
3D World Runner.
You definitely put that in the show notes, because I have an interested third party who's been looking for 3D World Runner to show up on WiiWare and would very much be interested in any way to play that.
Yeah, don't worry. I can help you out with that. But yes, later.
All right, so now we turn to our main topic today, which is a topic that transcends both... That's transcends is the wrong verb. That exists in both role-playing games and video games. That's the idea of an open world.
Open world gaming.
In case you've been living under a rock since 2003, the concept of an open world in a video game is that basically, instead of players going on one linear path from A to B, like your Call of Duties, your Dooms, your Gears of Wars, your stuff like that, most every video game made before... Actually, yeah, most every video game made before 2000... and even probably early 2000s. Whereas open world in a role-playing game is a bit more esoteric. And I don't have so much experience with that. So, Jeff, would you mind defining that for me?
I'll be covering that when we get to that, because first we're going to talk in a point-counterpoint, because there are definitely certain advantages about going with an open world environment when you're developing a video game, and certain advantages when we talk about going to a linear environment, and there are certain preferences in the player's side of the fence on playing open world versus playing, I don't want to call it closed world, I will call it directed play, as it were.
Now, linear. Real quick before Mike goes off again, there was open world games before 2000. There was open world games.
Yeah, I know about that. Like,
look.
I said most. I mean, like Final Fantasy.
No. There's been open world games. Even Zelda 2. There was an open world game on the Odyssey. Okay, open world gaming has been with gaming since the beginning.
What was the open world gaming on the Odyssey?
Haunted House.
Yeah. Could you go outside the haunted house?
Yes, you could.
Okay.
Could you go outside the haunted house's lawn?
No, but that's like saying in Grand Theft Auto, can I go outside of Vice City except for certain missions? No.
Actually, Liberty City. And I did just double check, Grand Theft Auto for PS2 came out on October of 2001. So it actually
okay. So
probably...
so I screwed up. Okay, it's been around for a while.
No. I was about to say I'm giving you credit to say. I think as far as the last-gen and current-gen video gaming experience, that 2000 is a good time to say that's when open-world gaming started hitting the public consciousness.
Recently it's become more of a major movement. People are starting to draw the line and take sides.
All right, so let's talk about what a player can really enjoy about an open world gaming environment, and we have a chosen champion for this topic.
Yes, I will slay all those who come before me. By which I mean this will be a probably fairly non-aggressive discussion. By which I mean there will be skulls on stakes in front of my house by the end of this conversation. Okay, so basically, in case you couldn't tell by that little mini rant power trip, I'm the open world champion, in case you're slow, in which case, good job downloading a podcast off of iTunes.
And if any of you have more than half a brain cell, you must realize that I am the linear champion.
And Jeff is playing, I'm guessing, Devil's Advocate slash Moderator. But let's stop dancing on the thing I'm supposed to be doing, shall we?
Yes.
Alright, so basically, the things that you can get, the things that a player can get that are positive out of an open-world sandbox free-roam game, it means that, A, it means that there's so much stuff to do, and you, most of the time, assuming that the developer has at least, has, which they almost always do, has stocked the open world with enough content, it means that there will be hours and hours of entertainment, almost certainly more than the average linear game. There will be much more due to the side missions and possible collectibles, assuming they're all done properly and correctly. I'm looking at you, Prototype. Okay, no, small tangent here. Prototype did it wrong because the collectibles would only appear due to the pop-in if you were like 20 feet away from them, which is a problem if your game world is Manhattan.
I like Prototype, but I'm not going to disagree. Continue.
And then other things that it gives is that it really creates this feeling that you're, that this kind of world is more realistic and living than in a fake world. Let's just go through GTA 4's Liberty City, and you'll see a world that appears to be going on even without you, whereas in a linear game, you kind of get to see a couple alleyways of the world, and it's like, oh, there's a tree that's blocking my path. Why can't I just jump over the tree? It's like 2 feet tall. Or I could just burn it. I have a lighter. The tree is fireproof.
So one of the strengths you would definitely cite to open-world gaming is immersion, immersiveness.
Yes, they're very immersive. And also, it really just gives a much better ability than a... Even though there's arguments against this, it gives a very much better... It's much better than a linear game at, like, expanding a game's mythology. Letting you understand the world as a whole, as opposed to just in a... Now, there are some games where... linear games where you can go through and you understand, like, the game, how the world works and all that fun stuff. But, I mean, like, in a game like Mass Effect or Oblivion, by the end of the entire experience, you really think you have an understanding of this world, its general swaths of its history, its mythologies, its gods, its magic, all of that, or its spaceships, if it's sci-fi, or
Michael, you
whatever's.
Cannot keep playing both sides of the fence.
Fine.
Actually, I will drop one statement here, which is to say, I would at least somewhat question the open-worldness of Mass Effect, especially Mass Effect 2, because certainly there is some freedom to go about the universe, the galaxy, explore different planets, but they certainly have a very strong skeleton of you have to find these companions and then run the Freedom's Progress mission. You have to find these companions and then run the Derelict Reaper ship mission, which, yeah, I'm not really spoiling much because you kind of, well, I'm spoiling a little bit. But anyway,
thanks,
Mass Effect spoilers.
Thanks, Jeff.
There is a balance that some games have. Well, you're only playing Mass Effect 1. You got, like, you know, years until you get here.
You don't even know what a Reaper is.
So anyway, the idea being that sometimes a game
I'll give you a hint. Cuttlefish.
Cuttlefish?
Cuttlefish.
I suppose. All right. There is a balance to be struck in some games between the open-worldness of player freedom and the closed-worldness of plot construction. And some games have struck... They are still called open-world. Like, I will have no problem calling Mass Effect an open-world setting, but it certainly draws some internal integrity from it, the minimum amount of linearity it's put in. So, back to you, Mike.
All right, and then, I guess Mass Effect's kind of contained open worlds, if that isn't too oxymoron-y.
No, that's fine.
It's capsules of open world that you pass from one to the next to the next to the next. And then, not to mention, just with an open world, it gives your players the ability to just completely, I'm pretty sure I'm restating myself here, but you can just completely immerse yourself in the world. The one thing everyone said about Oblivion, and what I do whenever I play an MMO, it's, screw the quest, I'm going to go that way and see what I find. This is the kind of adventure and exploration you don't get in a linear game, where it's like, oh, I wonder what's that way. Oh, 2-foot-high wall, can't go that way. Let's just keep going down main questville. Whereas in an open-world game, you can just set off and create your own exploration, which tends to be more motivating than with a game-developed objective.
That's okay. Yeah, that's true. With a game where the player is setting the narrative, there is certainly an idea that the player can feel much more in control, which means the player is much more likely to commit fully and, you know, really integrate themselves into everything that can happen inside the game world.
Mm-hmm. Because I know in Oblivion, I cared a lot more about just walking around and making my guy better and discovering new things than I cared about stopping whatever his face was. I beat the game 5 days ago and I can't remember what the final boss's name is. That's how much I preferred my exploration. I can remember every single dungeon I went to and the explorations I had there, but I can't remember the final boss's name.
Which is odd, because I can remember the final boss's name, but I don't think... I mean, having been chastised for spoilers, I'm not sure I want to say it.
No, it's pretty... It's... No, it's not really... It's not really a spoiler. You kind of... Yep, that's it. That's not a spoiler.
Okay, fine.
It's Dagon. Marunus Dagon.
Dagon?
You pretty much get told... Not Fish Dagon.
Now I'm never playing Mass Effect.
Even though it's Oblivion.
Hey, we're talking about Oblivion now. But it's funny that you use walk around for Oblivion, because I would briefly branch off to a discussion there of the fact that they tied leveling to picking certain skills that your character was good at and focused on, because there's nothing more ridiculous in that game than running around leveling up because you have selected athletics, the running skill, as one of your three critical skills. That is an easy way, by the way, to be completely outmatched by monsters midway through the game because you've spent the game running and leveling up.
Oh yeah, well, my one complaint with that game is that it forces you to pick those main skills really fast, so I ended up picking a bunch of random crap I never used. However, it was really fun because there was not a single person that played that game that did not just jump everywhere just because he got free XP for it.
I will actually save the long story I have about Oblivion. I think, see, that's actually one of the things, is that I actually constructed a minor narrative about my experience in Oblivion, and I will credit the open worldness to it, the fact that I was dropping my own narrative into what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, you can create your own narratives in an open world game. I realize I'm kind of shutting Mark out here, and after this little point, we'll let him talk.
The point and counterpoint. This is open world game. Mm-hmm.
But it's like, even in, I'm going to call this an open world game, in Assassin's Creed 2, at least, not so much in Brotherhood, but I'd play the game as if I was a different character. Like, I remember one of my, just to give myself a little bit of a challenge to my own personal objectives, like, one time I played as a schizophrenic, so every time I killed anybody, I always made sure the first thing I would do is I'd hide absolutely all the evidence. So it'd be like, I'd be pitching bodies into rivers, I'd even be pitching their weapons, which is much more difficult than it sounds and really time-consuming. But it was interesting and it was fun, because it kind of made my own narrative to go along with the main narrative, that Ezio is this kind of crazy, like, paranoid schizophrenic who's overly conscious.
Calling someone who conceals evidence of their crimes schizophrenic, I'm much more reluctant to use that term and use something like, you know, intelligent. You know, I'm going to conceal the evidence of this crime rather than, you know, run from the police for the rest of my life, you know.
Well, great. Now my internal narrative is ruined. Thanks.
You're welcome. So that actually, I think, is a good overall discussion of the advantages of and description of open world environments. So as not quite the moderator in this, but at least the neutral party who tends to like both sides, we are going to turn it over to Mark now and say, Mark, tell us about linear gaming.
Well, when you go, at least for me, when I go to a store and I pick up a game, I'm staring at the shelf and I see, oh hey, Dementium 2. I pick it up, I look at the back, and I say, this game sounds really awesome. I can't wait to run around in an insane asylum and shoot monsters. So then I come home, I put it in my DS, I sit down, and I play Dementium 2. If I want to go out and play, you know, Wacky Crazy Man Runs Through World of Warcraft, then I'll go out and play Wacky Crazy Man Runs Through World of Warcraft. When I pick up a game, I want an experience. I want to be able to sit down, I want to go into the head of Tony Ramirez or whoever and play his adventure. Now, I will admit that I do play open world games like Grand Theft Auto, Shenmue, etc., etc. In fact, one of my favorite games of all time, Star Control 2, is an open world, technically. But when I play them, I always go, okay, I did that mission, here's the next mission. Okay, I did that mission, here's the next mission again. Because I'm not there to faff about. I want to experience the game itself. Now, in an open world, you do get those supplementary experiences, but for the most part, you're denying yourself the actual experience of playing Tony Ramirez. You're playing as Jimmy McWaffle Boy.
So you're saying that some of the immersion that's present in a linear game comes from the very structured narrative, the fact that there is a story being told through the tool of the game that is, you know, similar to a book or a movie, in that you can get very integrated into the motivations of the character because you don't have to assign them yourself. You can immediately
exactly
perceive
and
what's going on.
I'm going to name drop someone that you all don't know, but he knows who he is. Gamma. You cannot experience full character immersion when you're playing a proxy of yourself. You can only experience full character immersion when you are playing as Mario, when you are playing as Kirby, when you are playing as Tony Ramirez. You're not you, you're them. Thus, role-playing. Sorry.
No, that's actually fair enough, which is to say, for a game to be, that's actually a separate side topic we could shoot into later, which would be, can you be playing a role-playing game when the character you're playing is yourself, which actually is a vulnerability, I suppose, of open-world games, which is, you know, you tend to be assigning more of your personal values to what's going on in the action because you're controlling it and directing it much more.
Well, to that point, this is kind of a cheapsy argument, but who really plays themselves in a video game? I mean, I'm not going to run over 30 hookers in a sprite truck, but when I play Grand Theft Auto, I might.
Keep in mind, at least for writing, about one of the truest axioms that's out there is how many characters appear in a book? One, the author. It's strings and pieces of yourself that you put into these characters. And, you know, there are certainly, you know, the advent of road rage is nothing new. Certainly there is something to say, you know, there's a humanistic element of saying these are all people in these cars around me. And there's this inhumanistic element of saying, idiots, get out of my way. So I think that, you know, normal people feel rage as well as happiness, and therefore some of these elements that are otherwise suppressed in any kind of normal interaction can come out in these written interactions, or indeed in these very private open world gaming aspects. But open world was the other side. Let's talk about linear gaming again. And I actually will butt in for a second to say that I actually prefer this arm for one specific reason, not totally, but how do they say it? User-generated content. I will start here with Little Big Planet. Not my game. Not my game at all, because really, especially what I've seen of Little Big Planet 2, is this game construction kit. And I've seen game construction kits for decades. And it's going to the store, looking at the Wii rack, the rack of Wii games, and saying, there are over 900 Wii games here. Three of them are good. Find them. And
it's a scavenger hunt. It's part of the game.
That's why user-generated content has usually turned me off. Because, yes, I will freely admit, Counter-Strike, Defense of the Ancients, a couple others occur to me as truly awesome user-generated content. But for every single one of those jewels, there's 300 pieces of crap littered around, and unless you have some kind of guide, you're not going to be able to pick out which are the enjoyable experiences. You're going to pick 10 random ones, have more than likely 8 or 9 complete disasters, and walk away. I probably have had that happen, which is why I probably would never want to pick up Little Big Planet 2, because if I'm going to get a platformer, and this actually kind of tailors to the whole discussion, I'm going to get a platform where someone has written the thing to be engaging and challenging and still fun. Because I trust game developers more than I trust the general public. I mean, that's how to say that.
That's true. I mean, I have an experience with a program called Adventure Game Studio that I'm planning on using at one point to write an old-fashioned point-and-click adventure game. And I was looking through the libraries, because you could post your game up on their website and people will play it. In total, I saw maybe 9-10 things that look good, 6 of which was made by the same person, which in case you're interested, is Yahtzee from Zero Punctuation. His games are actually pretty fun. But, I mean, then add some other good ones, and then the rest is just crap. No offense if you make games on Adventure Game Studio, but step up your content a bit.
The opinions expressed in this portion of the program do not reflect the opinions of Gaming
or,
Asylum.
Or, you know, me. That's a Gaming Asylum Michael at gmail.com.
So, returning to directed gaming, as it might actually be called, we've talked about some of the advantages. Let's talk about some of Mark's more recent experiences with it. Give us a few examples that you would cite as some of your best
directed gaming experience. Some of the best directed gaming experience I've had, huh? Well, sadly, I have to say that I haven't played much in the way of any games recently to completion, but I can cite one of the few ones that I did. That would be Castlevania. No, not the PlayStation 3 one, the Nintendo one. When I sat down and I played a literally zero narrative game, it's an experience that you have to be able to lose yourself in. One of my favorite quotes from any book ever is, "You have to lose yourself in the dream, otherwise you'll never have any fun." I'm not saying that I go all nuts and think I am Simon Belmont, but when the only thing I'm focusing on is that little screen between my hands or the big screen in front of me, I am in the persona of Simon Belmont, experiencing the things he is experiencing. Now, does that make sense to you guys, or am I just nuts?
It does, actually. Mike, go ahead.
I understand what you're saying perfectly, but Jeff?
I think the idea here is actually similar to the one that I was expressing, which is that if you've got a writer generating that story for you behind the scenes of the game development, you know, that goes back to user-generated content, that may actually be a more compelling narrative to the player than the narrative that the player comes up with. There's arguments to say that can't happen because the player is generating the narrative, but there are arguments to say that the narrative generated by the professional writer behind the development can be more dramatic. It can have bigger twists and turns. And that's actually one thing that we may come back to later, is that for an open world, it's really difficult to surprise the player because there's really a lot of self-generated content and not a lot of game-generated content in terms of, you know, the narrative. So certainly a direct-to-gaming experience can surprise you effortlessly and in extreme ways that can still sustain the suspension of disbelief, which is what you're talking about. Yes. The game has to live
through. If I'm playing a game, and I guess I said this already, I want to experience the adventure in the game. I'm not going to make up my own adventure unless I'm really bored when I'm sitting there playing Frogger and it's like, well, why's the frog doing this? Oh, well, maybe, you know, he's the last of the Croatian bullfrogs and he has to, you know, he has to crossbreed with every frog race and da-da-da-da-da forever and ever. When you play Pac-Man, do you imagine a small circle, or do you think about that retarded-looking guy on the Pac-Man Atari cover? Because I promise you, you think of a small circle.
I can't argue with that. I don't think of okay. Stupid Pac-Man.
I think of an amorphous creature that has a really bad head.
Oh, he's got to take his pills?
Because he's eating all these aspirin going around.
Oh.
Yes, he's eating all this medication and aspirin, laying all over the room. He's actually kind of a drug addict.
Yeah, I think it's a bad acid trip, personally. With four friends trying to take you to rehab.
Actually, no, that's the thing, though. The Pac-Man board consists of hundreds and hundreds of aspirin and four, like, you know, ounces of crack or something sitting on the corners of the board. And as soon as you take that, the police are alerted.
No, but
and that's what the ghost mechanism
But by that logic, when you take that, you somehow, by taking the crack, you're able
it's,
to defeat
It's less crack and more
cops.
Angel dust.
Well, that's right, because that's when you become psychotic enough to draw your weapon against the cops.
I think Pac-Man is, in fact, Dave Smith, who is a rampant LSD addict. And so as he takes more and more LSD, everything turns more into a giant Pac-Man port. And he has four different colored friends that he gives
now,
rhyming nicknames that are trying to get him to go to rehab.
Shoe.
Now, I think here we're coming into what might be described as the best sequel ever to Eternal Darkness.
Yes.
I want that game so bad.
It starts off as this whole, like, Eternal Darkness adventure, but then as you go deeper and deeper in, it slowly morphs into Pac-Man.
Well, I don't know if I'd call that the best sequel ever, but the framework.
And then your character just screams, "No, this isn't real," and you're back in the game.
See, because, I mean, that's the thing, is that in Eternal Darkness, which the moments of insanity were very cool, but the fact that you had this insanity restore spell kind of killed that two-thirds of the way through the game. I mean, you never really experienced them anymore, because you could just go, "Restore sanity," and that would be it.
But
it was really kind of depressing.
Now, I do want to break in right here. Yes, no, I just wanted to say, just as a tangent back to this, I didn't refuel my sanity unless it was absolutely necessary.
Fair enough. Okay, I did just from an efficiency point of view, and I suppose, yes, I did deny myself. I never did get to see the insanity moment where it's deleting the save games off your file.
Right. Now, I apologize for interrupting. Please continue your point, Mr. Bailey.
No, actually, that was the point. Just that, you know, as a side to the whole Pac-Man thing, it would be really cool if they created an Eternal Darkness where you literally distort your perception according to the way the game proceeds. And actually, they could really integrate that to make, you know, the last third minus end boss of Eternal Darkness literally unique to the player.
That would be interesting.
On a little tangent, my perfect game with a sanity meter wouldn't actually show you the sanity meter. So at first, when things start going crazy, you don't notice it, and you think it's actually part of the game. And that's this little sanity effect. Like, you see something falling, and you're like, oh god, there's totally an enemy somewhere around here. Like, a face falls, and you're like, oh god. But then your sanity meter slowly builds up, and you can't see it build up. And then all of a sudden you see, like, ghosts flying through the air, and you're like, yep, I'm insane now.
Now, that's actually a thing I'll draw back to our discussion, which is, in an open-world environment, many games decide to be fair to the player and put all of the information on the table so that as the player develops their open-world experience, they can guide it in the way they see fit. In a direct gaming experience, it's much more plausible for the game developer to take all that information off the table and say, you know, you're playing the life of Johnny Ace and you don't know how insane he is right at the moment.
Yes. If I ever do get back into GMing and I run Call of Cthulhu, which is what I want to run, then I want to run something where your character's sanity is blanked out and I, as the GM, know and can say things. And then it's like, oh, is there really a spider crawling down the front of my glasses? Or am I just seeing it? And to me, that would make the experience much more, frantic.
Now, let's compare that to at least a little bit of what I know about Condemned 2, which I believe Michael has played.
Yes, I have.
How would you respond to that statement he just made based on your experience of Condemned 2?
Condemned 2 is definitely like that. Now, granted, there's some bits where you know for a fact, like, yep, I'm freaking crazy. Mostly the first levels, mostly, in that entire thing. It's just, you go, and it's fairly realistic. It starts off with your generic Condemned hobo brawl, and then you can pretty much just instantly tell, just, alright, just walking along, this is kind of like, I'm insane, this is really obvious. It's not that subtle. It's like walking along the alleyway, oh, there's a little bit of black goop stuff, that's kind of, oh, everything's covered in it now, and now I'm being attacked by zombies, I'm totally crazy. It's not subtle, it's more of a freight train of insanity.
Alright.
Although I do have to give them credit for not doing the thing almost every game with a insanity meter does, which is your vision goes blurry and everything gets shaky. Because as everyone knows, the first thing that happens when you go insane is you get cataracts.
That's very true. That's why LASIK places are very, very interesting places. No, the idea here actually that we can transpose back is to say, is it possible that in an open gaming environment, in order to effectively communicate events to you, the game developer is a little bit more restricted on the universality of the signals they use, like, for instance, insanity being blurred vision, whereas in a directed gaming experience, like, say, Eternal Darkness, you can get a lot more free and punchy with what you're doing only because you've set down this iron rail that everything is supported by.
I completely agree. When you are playing a game that has sanity effects, I feel it has to be linear, because the game has to tell you that you're experiencing the insanity effect. Not in a, oh, hey, check it out, that's an insanity effect, but in a stop, something happens. If you're doing an open world game and all of a sudden, like, you see something out of the corner of your eye, you could be on the opposite side of the screen and you won't even notice it because you're in the other side of the town. You understand what I'm saying? You have to be able to look at the only things you can see is your screen. In an open world game, you can see an entire world. But in a linear game, you have the area right in front of you. And with that, you can do a lot more with messing with the perspective.
Now, actually, I'm going to take up that point a little bit to compare and contrast in terms of urgency of events. In an open world game, they can certainly give you some experience of the contingency of events, one depending on another, happening in rapid succession. But in real life, to honor the interface, you can be told by character X, you have to hurry! This is going to happen any second! And then you can go off and do 3 side missions and come back and then do what's going on. Which can, if the player thinks...
Are you telling me the same thing doesn't happen in Grand Theft Auto? Or Final Fantasy VII?
Well, now that's the thing, though, is I would term Grand Theft Auto as a very open world, and Final Fantasy X, I mean, I know I'm going to, you know, sound sacrilegious by saying it's directed, but it really is, if only because the stories offered in Final Fantasy are a lot more in-depth and characterized than you're a mobster, you're on the streets of Liberty City. I mean, I know that Grand Theft Auto IV especially had much more of a storyline than that, but I still think that to play Final Fantasy, especially after Final Fantasy VII, is a lot more about what the characters are going through, and to play Grand Theft Auto is a lot more about what can I do in this world, given the freedom.
Now, admittedly, and I'm not trying to put this into a side topic, and I really hate citing Final Fantasy VII for anything, but the very first mission in Final Fantasy VII is a timed mission.
Oh, that's right. It's like escaping from... Yeah, all right. I'll give you that. But, and that actually is directed to its closed narrative status. And so, you know, in Oblivion, you know, you could have this, you know, you're in the middle of this thief-run mission where, you know, you're trying to break in this building, and you can literally just go off and do something else. And I've done that and come back. And that's necessary to create the player's narrative, but if done, I suppose I have to say this, irresponsibly, it can break the entire narrative that the game is trying to set up because it's relying on the player to be the writer. So that's compare and contrast.
Right, right. There's a scene in Final Fantasy VI where you have a party member that you just found after the entire world was destroyed, spoilers, who's holding up a house that's, like, breaking apart. And the game doesn't tell you this, but you have a soft time limit, and if you don't go in there and save him, then, and you can just leave, you can just walk out of town and do whatever, but if you don't go in there, he'll die, and you can never have him in your party again. So I feel like it's less to do with open world versus linearity, and just the game itself. All right,
now let's actually direct specifically to that point. Mark, how do you feel about events in games that are connected to a real-world chronometer? Did you enjoy that experience of having that character who needed to be saved within X real time.
I love Star Control 2, but the only way I could beat it was by sitting down with a guy, because I just couldn't wrap my head around, I only have 3 hours until it's too late to save the world and then I have to start over. But if I play a game like Darkseid, which is a really good H.R. Giger point-and-click adventure, that game takes place over real time, but in a way that Jenny says, meet me here on Thursday, and I think it's like 30 minutes is one full day, then you can go do whatever you want, as long as you remember that in 2 hours that you have to go meet Jenny, a.k.a. Thursday, then it's still an interesting game experience. So to me, it depends on what is happening. If the game has a hard time limit to finish the game, I find myself clustered and scared. But if a game says, oh, hey, you can do this if you want in a little while, then that's
now,
fine with me.
Is being scared a positive experience? Is it, you know, there is an argument to say the game is creating tension through the use of the clock. Do you respond to that point?
I love being put under pressure to do something. I would much rather a game sit there and say, look, if you don't do this, this is going to happen. And if I don't do it, I want consequences. Now, admittedly, this is a trope of the open world gaming, but when it happens in a linear game, it's much more jarring, and to me, gives it a much better
experience.
Actually,
I was about to throw it back to Mike with a counterpoint. I don't think open world gamings use clocks as much. In fact, I will say that the only times that the open world gaming experiences use specifically timed events is to encapsulate the narrative entirely, is to say, you have, you know, three hours until the world ends. That's how long you've got to play through this game. Michael, how do you find timed events in games? What's your response to that?
I actually don't mind it at all, because as I said earlier, I'm playing Dead Rising, and in case anyone's not played Dead Rising, everything in Dead Rising is on a timer. You have 72 in-game hours before, in one, it's until, whatchamacallit, in both of them, it's until the military arrives and gets your butt to safety. Or in Dead Rising 2, murders you. Spoiler alert. And then, that time limit, they space out, they very close. Dead Rising is an open world game. I'll go ahead and state that. It's definitely open world. You can just say, screw the quest, I'm going to go and put on women's clothing and murder zombies with sports equipment. Huzzah!
Yay, Dawn of the Dead.
And so, I don't find that timer that constraining, because the designers have made it just so that you do have free time in between the story missions, where if you do miss their time period, you will fail. And you can go off and you can also go do whatever. You can go do side missions, you can go rescue survivors or kill psychopaths that are timed, and you can fail those, but you can also skip them, and there's not really a big consequence. And you can just...
Okay, wait, real quick.
Yeah?
Michael, is the fact that you feel free to faff about during story events, the fact that you cannot express yourself as the character, I think his name is Tom something, as that character? Okay, well, is the reason that you can do whatever you want, even though you know there's a hard timer, and you see the Zombrex right there in front of you. Oh, no, I'm going to go over here and go get this. Is that the fact that you don't see yourself as the character? Or is that the fact that you almost have a disdain for wanting to act as though the character would act, and instead going to do the things that you, Michael,
would rather do? It's
definitely
me going to do what I'd rather do. But at the same time, I went through a run earlier where I was honestly going for achievements. So I spent the 3 days, I completely ignored the main mission and failed it, and just went to the sloths and made money. At the same time, no, this making money thing was obviously what I wanted to do. The main character, whose name is Chuck, or Frank if it's the first game, he would probably want me to go and do the main quest to clear his name, minor spoilers of Dead Rising Follow. But still, at the same time, even while I was doing this thing where I was paying the money, I'd still go grab my Zombrex and go give it to Chuck's 7-year-old child, or whatever. I don't know what age she is. Did I want to do this? No. But
if your real-life family member was dying of the zombie virus, and you had to go get Zombrex, would you look at the Zombrex and say, well, I'm going to go get some achievement by playing
well,
the
see,
slots?
Actually, that's
would you grab the Zombrex and go
back in and say, it is at least somewhat realistic for a character in a world that's being overrun by zombies, your own daughter is being turned into a zombie and it's only a matter of time, to literally retreat from that and go, I can't face any of this. I'm going to go into the slot machine room and lock the door. I mean, it's not, you know, it certainly doesn't seem like, you know, a laudable or even, you know, a commendable thing to do. But I suppose that is one of the freedoms of open world, is that your character can respond in a variety of ways, and it can still make internal sense in the narrative. If you're playing in a directed storyline and you're like going off trying to find, you know, the crop of collectibles that are in your zone, every other NPC in that world has the right to say, well, gee, Frank, what are you doing? In an open world, it's a lot harder to get in the way of the player's control of what type of narrative they're enjoying.
Now, Jeff, if you were playing Bioshock 1, and when Atlas says, would you kindly grab the wrench, or would you kindly put your weapon away, or, you know, would you kindly whatever, if you didn't have to do it, would the twist ending of the game been as powerful
as it was? Well,
actually, the
only way it works is because when they tell you of the major spoiler alert, by the way, the twist wouldn't work if they told you about it any earlier, because after they tell you about it and after it's used very compellingly in one more scene, it really doesn't impact the behavior of the game character anymore.
That particular plot point is basically pointing at this direct finger at the linear gameplay and going, look at the point we're making about this.
No, because if you didn't have to grab the wrench, if you didn't grab the wrench, then it was pointless.
Well, I think there is some validity to Mike's point to say, you know, we put you through this whole linear thing. No, it's not finger wagging. It's more efficiency. We put you through this whole linear gameplay story in terms of you have this objective and this objective and then this objective. You're free to wander around, but in order to progress, you will accomplish these objectives. And then it actually says, we're going to take the fact that we inconvenienced you a little bit like that and forced you to do these objectives and reward you for it by saying, "And oh, look, here's a massive twist you didn't expect that relies on those objectives and achieving those objectives to give you new insight into what the character's situation is."
Now, you do realize that, you do remember that all the NPCs, until you're done directly acting with the things that you wanted, that the game wanted you to do with them, kept them behind locked doors, right?
Oh, yes.
You remember that?
Not quite.
That was to keep you from...
There is an NPC that I believe you and I already talked about. I had a specific choice as to whether or not to interact with this NPC, and I chose not to, and you were surprised.
Okay, that one doesn't count. You're right. You're absolutely right about that one. But I'm talking about the rest
right.
of them.
Yeah, you're right. Everyone else they keep behind closed doors, and actually I'll go back to one of my other favorite, total favorite games, Dead Space, and say that one very much kept the NPCs behind closed doors, across chasms, and behind windows until such time as you were meant to either kill them or lead them to safety or something. And that's devices that now that's actually interesting, because that's a restriction based on directed gaming that can break the narrative. I mean, if you as a player of a directed narrative game have a legitimate reason to say, I'm suspicious of this character's motives, the directed narrative will still pull you along in trusting them long after you as a player have become so utterly suspicious that at this point you're just waiting for the betrayal.
Now, that's because the character is still trusting.
That's true.
Just because I think that you know, so-and-so is a bad guy doesn't mean Joe Smith, the character I'm playing as,
that's true,
he's a bad
but that
guy.
Leads us back to the kind of trope of sitting in the movie theater watching the horror movie and yelling at the screen, don't do that. Don't open the door, because it represents a break of suspension of disbelief on the part of the player or viewer to have the character continue to do these actions in defiance of strong evidence that they are not supporting the character and not friendly to the character's long-term interests. So that you have to watch out for in direct gaming is that you're keeping the character's actions within that story consistent not just to the character's perceptions, but to the player's perceptions. Because if the player becomes separated from the character, you've lost the dream, as you pointed out.
Absolutely.
So that's actually a vulnerability that the game designer of the directed narrative game has to do, is to make sure that every moment within the story is presented consistently so that the player is always empathizing with the character. In an open world environment, you don't need to do that very much because the player is so directing the action that it's kind of a moot point. You know, if you don't want to go get the Zombrex, you don't have to go get the Zombrex.
Yeah, but I don't know. I guess this is just the final, the final argument of someone who almost always plays the good character, is, you know, I want to go get the Zombrex. My character wants to get it. I want to get it. I'm going to go get the damn Zombrex.
Now, actually, I'll take this topic up for a second. In games with open world, you're much more likely to be presented with the much more modern development of, do you want to pick the good side or the bad side?
Which
now,
I hate.
You just said you play the good side. Oh, what? You hate this control?
Well, no, I hate the fact that it's either A or B. There are many times, especially in real life, that horrible place where we all have to deal with them, you know, in the periods we're not gaming, that it's not A or B, it's Z.
True, open world gaming, in order to support this trend of good versus evil, has had to draw very definitive and, in my opinion, somewhat ludicrous lines between, if you are good, it is good because you have constantly rescued puppies and transported them through hellfire into puppy shelters. If you're bad, you've been eating those puppies for health bonuses.
Yeah, and that's never really been perfected.
Right, and Can't I be baby-eating Mother Teresa? Do I have to be the baby-eating devil or Mother Teresa?
In terms of baby-eating, you kind of have to be the baby-eating devil. But anyway, but you're right. In open world, shades of gray are a lot harder to code into specific characterizations of the gameplay. You, generally speaking, if you're evil or good, they have to offer you very hard choices for that, or very defined choices. Difficult choices have not really been offered.
Right. Now, absolutely. And before we close out and finish our argument, I do want to point out that anything in the Shin Megami Tensei series, that includes Persona, Devil Children, Last Bible, etc., 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 anything made by those guys have ridiculously powerful, and they have good and evil, but they also have good and you happen to be lawful, good and you happen to be chaotic, good and you happen to be neutral, etc., etc. One of the Persona games, and I'm thinking of Persona 3, has 63 different endings.
That's a lot. Which one is this again?
If I'm not mistaken, it's Persona 1 or 3. And that happens to be all based on the demons that you carry with you, your actions in the game, the people in your party, the people you choose to sacrifice, and your interactions with all the NPCs in between.
Let's branch off to that point for a second to say replayability. Most of your open world games are very, very replayable because the user has so tailored the content to that specific experience. A lot of your directed games are not as economically viable for replay. This is the best exception I've ever heard of to have 63 different endings, except then you get to the point to say, you know, if you paid X money to buy this game, and in one playthrough, you're only going to experience, you know, 40% of the content, because in order to get to the others, you have to play it the other 62 times. that's a little bit of an imposition on the player, perhaps, it might be said. But certainly...
But to kind of jump on the earlier bandwagon, I mean, something, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but with those 63 endings, there's quite a few pairs that are only subtle variation, like one line of dialogue is said instead of the other. I mean, it's not like 62 completely different varying endings. I presume that they're kind of clumped together.
Now, yes and yes to both of you. Right, yes and yes to both of you, but in completely different ways. I was being a bit hyperbolicious and, you know, throwing out a huge number. I think the number might be, like, less than 20. And
but
yes, some of them are very
but
subtle
the idea
changes,
being that it's quite possible probably that some
for
of these
the most
20
part,
endings are grouped.
When I'm talking about it, I mean, because, like, in one of them, you destroy the world. In another one, you save the world. In a third one, you don't really destroy the world, but you don't really save either. You leave it in this blank purgatory. In another one, you learn how to bring all the demons in the world to make them, you know, viable things that we carry on in society with. In another ending, you actually dispel all the demons from the world, but you still leave it in this kind of weird purgatory. In another ending, you're not allowed to do anything. And you have to sit there and watch as your party members make that decision for you. So, yes, all the endings are different, but in, like, there's one ending that has a bunch of different variations depending on the things that you happen to have on you and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a bunch of big endings and then subsects.
To bring
of
a
those
bit more
endings.
Modern example of that, Fallout New Vegas both has both in my opinion, kind of surpasses the whole stupid morality scale thing, and it also has the multi-ending replayability. Basically, the game can end one of four ways. This isn't really a spoiler because anyone who's played the game will be instantly aware of how the game could end about 5 minutes in. The game can end with one of four factions taking over the city of Vegas. NCR, New California Republic, Caesar's Legion, Mr. House, or you. And now, granted, most of these endings are pretty similar, and you can't really stick around for the outsets, but none of them are really a good or bad ending. All of them kind of have a bit of a stint to them. It kind of implied that NCR is good, kind of implied that Caesar's Legion is evil, kind of implied that Mr. House is neutral, and kind of implied that you are super-duper neutral. But then every single side has its own little kicks to positivity or negativity. NCR is pretty much a giant conquering force that comes from California and just takes all these little settlements that were fine by themselves and just assimilates them and puts them in the war effort. Caesar's Legion, yeah, it does use slavery, but at the same time, it's also creating a coherent system with no infighting whatsoever, unlike the NCR. They've created, within Legion land, there is peace, and presumably once they could pull out the pit here, and once they finally conquer everything they need to conquer, they could just free the slaves and go, okay, we don't need you guys anymore, have fun with freedom. And then House is both good and evil, because he wants money, which is kind of iffy, but he also wants, like, peace for all the, and then you are pretty much are good evil as you want to play. And it's just a bunch of different endings that can turn out that all kind of have a good and a bad stint, plus all the little things you could do, whether or not you killed the raiders. It ends up creating this super-duper replayable process, because there are giant quest lines that go with each side. I mean, it's not just like the, if you're sided with NCR, you need to kill this guy, or if you're sided with Caesar, you just need to talk to him. I mean, no, it's like NCR shoots off this way in a path, and Caesar's Legion shoots off this way. You can't see, because this is an audio podcast, but that's a 180-degree spin. Or you could go with the screw you plan and murder everything in sight. And get a perk for eating the leader of every single faction.
Did they use the acronym NCR a lot
in
the game?
That's pretty much what they're referred to.
I would totally be looking at that as National Cash Register every single time.
No, it's New California Republic.
Okay. Mark, how would you defend the replayability of directed gaming? I mean, yes, there are the exceptions of, you know, Persona and stuff like that, where they put in, they take the time, which actually could be described as the massive effort on the part of the dev to put in extra endings. But more often than not for directed gaming, especially like just interactive fiction, you know, your Zork, your Infocom type game, it's very set as to where the writing is going because there's really only the one ending written. Replayability, Mark?
Replayability and linear gameplay. It's like sitting down and saying, why should I play Barnstorming again on the Atari? I guess this is the one point where my argument falters, and I have to admit that I'm a weirdo that replays linear games for the act of enjoying them. But I have to break it into two different subsections of linear gaming here. Like, yeah, that's actually what I was going to. There's enjoying the gameplay and enjoying the narrative, basically playing an RPG or, you know, playing an action game. Do I sit down and replay through Mario repeatedly because I enjoy the story? No, because I like Mario and I like running and jumping, etc., etc. But I sit down and play through Final Fantasy III because I'm very captivated by the story, and it's like sitting down to read a good book again.
Yep. And that's one of the things I think could be the replayability factor. Now, that's the thing, though, is that you hear a lot of people talk about, you know, I read Lord of the Rings once a year. Right now, you don't hear a lot of people saying, I replay this game once a year to revisit the narrative. And certainly, the massive problem is, given that video games are directly connected to technology, unless you save and maintain the systems that they were originally published on, it's hard to do that sometimes, to say, I'm going to keep playing this game 10 years down the line.
Yes, yes, you're right. As much as I know many people who sit down and say, oh, I play through Zelda once every 2 years because I enjoy the game. And you're right. I'm sitting on games right now that I don't own the systems for, like Snatcher on the Sega CD, that I can't play. I love the game to absolute pieces, but I can't play it. And that's a completely different argument for a completely different time.
Can't play it the first time or can't play it multiple times?
I have played it the first time, and I have enjoyed it the first time, but I can't play it again.
So it may be that with that expectation in mind, when the player acquires the video game, because of the way the video game experience has been framed in the culture, they don't look for the directed game to be the kind of experience they revisit like they revisit a book. And that's actually a fairly interesting dynamic to go, you know, there are people who will read a book over and over again to revisit these moments, but maybe if it's tied to gameplay that you get better and better at, the book, the narrative would get more and more disrupted to say, you know, this fight that you just got through was so challenging and you're recovering and you're talking to your friends because you're wounded, and in real life when you played that battle for the 37th time, you didn't take a hit. So directed gaming can run into these vulnerabilities, but at the same time, I still, as the person on both sides of the fence, believe that the linearity of it still is good to create an iron structure on which you can drop much more focused narrative than you can in an open world game where you literally have to respect the player's ability to go back to the first room they ever entered, you know, 80% of the way through the game. Bioshock 1 just played. I remember there's one moment where they kind of just say, if you're going to go back and try and get those little sisters, this is now the time because you have access to the submarine, the bathysphere that goes back to all the old areas. And so I had to literally go back to each area, load it up, and go, no, I got them all from here. So, you know, the dependency on the narrative is both a good thing and a bad thing for direct gaming, and, you know, I hate to say it this way, but vice versa for the vice versa.
Yes.
Yeah, I love the idea that both open world and direct gamings can give you unique and totally enjoyable experiences, and that's one of the great things about being a gamer.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that. I don't want either to disappear at any point. They're both awesome.
Now, I'm going to bridge right now to a place where I actually do kind of have an opinion, which is, and most people don't think of it this way, open world gaming in tabletop role playing games. Mark and I had a discussion about this a couple days ago. I'm going to recap some of it as we go on. But basically, I think the maturity of the player and the GM can almost be marked by their transition from closed world to open world. Almost every player who ever plays an RPG is introduced by the idea of the module, the adventure, the prepackaged storyline with the prepackaged beginning and the prepackaged ending. That is what I'm going to call closed world pen and paper games. And the problem is that even if you're running or playing in this, it's exposing you to this theory of how role-playing games are played and what they're meant to do to have fun with is to accomplish the narrative, to go through, find where the story is kind of meant to be taking you, and to act consistent with the motivations of your character that would get you to that end. This is widely called, you know, like cooperating with the GM, but if the GM's got story in front of him that's persuading him to go to this point to have the next story event happen, as the player, you're going to pick up on that, and your narrative for your own character is going to twist towards that way. Now, the problem is that this is very similar in many respects to reading a good book, and books are very good experiences. I thoroughly recommend reading. But when you take that framework of enjoyment and you transfer it to role-playing games, I think you miss half the boat. Because if you as a GM start writing your own content, you're going to take the legitimacy of the module as your guideline to say, I'm going to write an adventure with a big baddie at the end, with set locations that I can describe in effortless detail in the middle, events that happen based on a timeline, that stuff like that, and you get very trapped into this. Even a loose narrative will require assumptions. And one thing that GMing for any length of time will tell you is that if you got 4 to 6 players around the table, one of them is going to break your assumptions, and it's going to break it in such a way that you're going to have to do some major stitch work to get the narrative you intended to bring to the players back to them. Now, as a GM, you can do all this behind the scenes. You can just, you know, you can use the magician's forces. You can use, you know, you were meant to go to town A, but you're going to town B. Now the story is happening at town B. But you start getting this real tug of war there, and there's a certain competitive instinct in the human being that will actually take some players, and I've seen this, some GMs, that road leads to player versus GM. And that's a very ugly place to be. What I think most people miss in the possibility of role-playing games is what I'll refer to as open-world gaming. You have a signature event that starts at a reason the party is together and interested in accomplishing an objective, like, you know, there's an attack on their headquarters or something like that. All the GM has to do at that point, really, is select a couple of major antagonists and decide on their motivations. Select a range of mid-level operators and who their allegiance is to and how strongly. Put together a couple of locations you would expect that the party would need to go to pursue their involvement with this, and then give the players license to write part of their story by telling you where they're going and what they're interested in. The idea being that if they're participating in the narrative by saying, we want to look up this information on Baddie X, you can bring up the lights on Baddie X and say, well, Baddie X is now much more integral to the plot because that's where they are looking, which suggests that's what they're thinking and interested about. And you can say, all right, Baddie Y and Baddie Z, they were taking peripheral roles in this, whereas Baddie X, he's the main architect. And now that influences mid-level A and mid-level B to be with that guy. It's tough. The reason that most RPGs start with adventures and fixed modules is because this style of gaming is darn tough on the GM. You have to be experienced at it to go, I can put this story together, not quite on the fly, but at least in 4 hour to 6 hour stints of raw writing right there at the table. But the problem is, the more that the RPG industry uses these crutches to get people into the hobby at all, that means the more likely it is that the hobby will continue to persist to be these very tightly written narratives where, you know, it's enjoyable as a book, but it's not enjoyable as a game, not really, because the players don't have any control, no real control. This is railroading. This is all 100% railroading. Now, Mark and I had this discussion a couple days ago, and he is reevaluating just about every RPG he's ever seen under this kind of new to him lens of, I could do anything with this. Now, I'm interested in hearing Mike's reaction to this material, because I think it's one of the first times I've actually said it in this focused narrative. What's your response to this material, Mike?
My response is that, in theory, I'd just love to... Well, let me start this off with an irritating gaming story. My first game with my current group was a D&D game, where honestly they were all new to gaming, so I knew I could get away with every single trope in the book. So I started them off with a little bitty village somewhere. I made them go into a crypt and fight demons, I think, some little demon monster things. And then finally I got them to go over to and go through my plot train-o-matic, and they went to a big city. And I was like, okay, I've got this big plot, this is gonna turn awesome. We're eventually gonna reach some big, awesome fights and things I think they'll really get into. We never really got past that point, because what I thought was gonna be a linear story, my players kind of suck in terms of following hints, and they were just like, yeah, I know there's this quest and
listen,
all.
Listen to that sentence.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, but back, your players suck at following hints, so they were in the big city, and what happened?
And so I'm like, alright, and so you wake up, and you realize that your contact from the village told you to meet him at the harbor today. And they're like, great, we go the other direction. What? We go the complete other direction. I'm like, okay, whatever. And so eventually, within 5 minutes, I just pitched my notes off to the side, and I'm like, I don't need these anymore. And what I planned to be a linear game became now the players stealing cattle from someone, I believe, and then creating their own underground cursed weapons business. I was like, okay, I'm perfectly fine with this.
I'm glad you rolled with it. That is a moment of GM player adversarialness in terms of, we know the story is over there, we're not going over there, that turned into cattle rustling, which you don't often see in RPGs.
It became cattle rustling, and they tried to sell the cattle back to the person they stole it from. And succeeded.
That is hopefully, and I use this kind of tentatively, but that hopefully is a moment of growth as a GM for you to see how the apparent treachery of the players led to something that is quite enjoyable.
And so with that, I come up with this anecdote. No matter what the DM says, the DM sits down and goes, or DM, I don't know, D&D, the GM says, the other night he sits down and goes, this is going to be a linear game, I know how this is going to begin, this end. Or if he opens up a notebook and goes, I'm just going to draw out this town and 100 different things that could be in there, and we'll see what they grab onto. The players could instantly... It depends on the players. The players can very easily switch a linear game to an open world game, or the open world game to a linear game. They can take the linear game and say, yeah, there's the plot, but screw that. Or they could take the open world game and find one plot point and went, this is awesome, we're following this. And they can very easily in that way switch between the two, should they so feel. So there's really no point in planning for it. You gotta plan for a bit of both.
Now, Mark, I want you to describe the reaction to the discussion we had a couple days ago, given Mike's reaction to it.
Well, I can't really reenact the scene of me, like the beast, trumbling through my lair, throwing all my RPG notes into a pile, and like staring, falling on my knees in front of my RPG books, going, no! But...
You didn't do that. You reevaluated them with gold in your eyes, you were saying.
I did. Instead of, and this is something I'll talk about a little bit more in my wins and fails, but I now see everything in a completely different light. Instead of buying an RPG book, flicking through the notes saying, meh, how can I make a story with this, and then throwing it on the shelf, now I can sit down and say, this is cool stuff that could happen, but whatever, that's not up to me.
Now,
but I'm
I like
glad
where
I have
that
these tools
that's
to be able
to
pull to if
me,
they do so happen to be
which
on the 13th
GM
level of Vastel Plain and they're in the sound
GM's
corridor screen of Minocket. What now?
I'm saying, the sentence you were about to finish, which is, I like this story element, but that's not up to me. I think every GM should have it printed on their side of the GM screen. The story isn't just up to you. I mean, it's that I was vulnerable to that to many years, and it really came down to, if I want a game to work like that, if I want a game to be the story, I'm better off writing the damn thing myself. That's a book I'm writing, not a game. A game is only a game because the players are there, and that means the story isn't up to you.
It's up to them.
Yeah, that
you just. I'm gonna say what I told you. Like one of the first things I said afterwards, I said, it's not like a video game. In a video game, the game provides the go, you provide the do. In an RPG, I now realize, the players provide the go, you provide the do.
Yep.
Precisely.
So that's more or less the presentation I wanted to make on pen and paper open world gaming, which is just to say that the more the GM, I mean, you know, to use the old quote, the more the GM tightens his grip, the more players will slip through his fingers.
It's like, I don't know, what would that be, like Jell-O?
Well, actually, it's sand as far as Star Wars The New Hope is referred to.
Well,
the more the tighten your grip, the more star systems will slip
through
his fingers.
Never happened.
Through A New Hope. I like
my
Jell-O
happened?
Metaphor better.
I like your Jell-O metaphor better, but I will say, as far as Star Wars, Episode 4, it tends to be regarded as the only good one.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I thought you said Episode 1. My brain exploded at the thought of Jar Jar Binks, who doesn't
exist. Jar Jar Binks?
He's a character directed at 5-year-olds to make them happy while their grown-up parents are watching.
It's someone that I was incredibly happy because I picked up Lego Star Wars just so I could hop him off of bridges.
Much the reason why Wesley Crusher has yet to appear in an RPG.
Except he's totally plot mandatory.
Alright, I think that's the point.
You know who my favorite Star Wars characters is? And I'm sorry, I have to say, in Lego RPG, my favorite character ever is the Gonk droid. The stupid slow thing that doesn't do anything. I love him so much.
I'd always
much.
Pick him that way I could just spin around in a circle repeatedly for no reason because it looks hilarious.
I kind of think my favorite character is Vorlom just because he fills both the droid and bounty hunter requirements for doors, locks, and bombs. But, you know, that's just me.
My favorite character is Jar Jar because I get to jump him off of bridges.
Actually, the character I would play most often than not in LEGO Star Wars is General Grievous. I mean, he doesn't have the droid thing, but the sabers are unmistakably, you know, you take a hit once every 20 shots, maybe 15 shots, but with General Grievous, you can just lay down the deflection and go, no, you are not hitting me. It will take me 30 minutes to dance and pirouette across this board to get to you, but in the meantime, you are not shooting me once.
Yep, pretty much.
Now, the best Star Wars game I've ever played was one of those stupid little plug-in-to-your-TV games that gave you this little stick that was a lightsaber, and you had to, like, lightsaber duel bosses. And one of the bosses was Grievous, who, like, destroyed me. Especially, like, I killed him once, and then he pulls out 4 lightsabers, and I got, like, 2 HP left, and I'm like, and I turn the
now,
game off.
Now, I will take this moment to cast aspersions on you for using the word best Star Wars game ever and not following it up with the words Knights of.
Yes, very much.
But that's a sin to you and not the world.
Eh. I don't like open world games,
call,
remember?
Knights of the Old Republic open world. It does have some side missions, but the narrative is very much You are a specific character, and the narrative takes you through four places. It does give you the choice whether to be light or dark side, but it, you know, once you make that choice, it's very restricted into what you can do and how your combat will look. I still, as far as story goes, and I will, I mean, I think story in a video game is very much the hallmark of a directed play experience. I believe that Knights of the Old Republic is one of the only games I actually consider canonical, like, you know, just very, you do not spoil that narrative. It is that good. I will accidentally spoil BioShock narrative. I will never accidentally spoil Knights of the Old Republic narrative. I found the story that compelling.
Spoiler alert, you play as a
okay,
Jedi.
That I'll spoil. Just because you eventually have to choose between light side and dark side, but after that. Okay, I think we've very well hashed out some of our thoughts on open world gaming to the point where we would love to hear from the audience on anything they have to say as a response to these statements and ideas and topics. We want to hear from you on iTunes. We want to hear from you to our individual email addresses, and we'd love to have you stop in at the Gaming Asylum website.
Which we'll all plug at the end. But now we're moving on to our wins and fails for this week. Jeff, you start. Oh, or Mark. Mark, you start.
I have to be the weird one and go ahead and split my wins and fails into two groups again. And my first win is the fact that with YouTube's time limit being removed, you can upload any amount of any film that you want. And Psychedelic Eyeball took it upon himself to throw up his 2.5-hour video of him and a bunch of other people playing Worms. And it is the most boring, utterly horrible thing that I absolutely hate myself for watching. But I love it. So, win to Psychedelic Eyeball for trapping me for the third time into watching this 2.5-hour video. Fail to me for actually falling for it again for the third time.
And then set number two?
That would be the first win is actually an apology win to every RPG ever made. I'm sorry that I threw you on the shelf, and I apologize, and the fail, which is me again, I will read every RPG that I own again in a completely new light.
Doo-doo-doo, I think.
The more you know.
Just have this scene of me hugging all my RPG books, and there's like all these hearts.
Okay, I will go next. And my first win goes to Game Informer again. This is kind of a spin-off of my win from last time, although I'm focusing on one thing in particular. They did a complete replay, as in from start to finish, for like 6 hours, of a game called Overblood for the PS1. And I'm pretty much casting my vote for Overblood as the worst survival horror game ever made in the history of forever. And, again, this thing's 6 hours.
I could beat you on a few of those. And also, FU Game Informer Sheep Man is awesome.
And so then, so this is a 6-hour set of videos. It's really, really long. But, I mean, it's infinitely hilarious. Them stumbling through this god-awful game.
6 hours of Overblood?
Hey. It's the entire game. And at least an hour of it is them...
They must really suck at Overblood.
An hour of them stumbling through, confused, having no idea what to do.
That's the joy of being an old-school gamer watching new reviewers tackle old-school games.
It was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
And then my other win...
High five, Jeff.
My other win goes to Snow for keeping me out of school for the last week. Pretty simple. And then my two fails go to the new Green Lantern movie for starring that guy that's in every romantic comedy ever and looking god-awful, in my personal opinion. I'm not going to say humble, but personal.
Green Hornet and Seth Rogen?
Lantern and what's-his-face.
Is it Ryan Reynolds?
Yes, Ryan Leonard. Blah, 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 Ryan Reynolds.
Okay.
And God, I just hate that. And the other fail goes to me for completely ignoring the Super Bowl today.
That's not really a fail.
In some eyes, it's a fail.
What are you talking about?
All right, I'm going to go mine. My first win is for Visceral Studios out of EA because if I had, you know, an actual income right now, I would actually be on the fence about purchasing a PS3 Move, because in Dead Space 2 for the PS3, the, I think it's the collector's edition, they bundled Extraction, the whole game, which is a Wii game, and that just, as someone who hadn't had a chance to really play Extraction yet, because it hadn't really dropped below $30, that would have been the absolute best time for me to consider both the game and the peripheral. It was a brilliant move, and I thought Extraction was still one of the best reasons so far for a serious story-based hardcore gamer, or, you know, serious gamer, to consider the movement peripherals is for stuff that Extraction was doing. The other win I'm going to assign is to Zynga. Some of you may know the name. It's the studio that makes many, many of the popular Facebook games, because they somehow had this intuitive notion of when someone would have mastered every single crop there is to its 3-star mastery level, and within 2 to 3 days of this person I know very well mastering all of the crops, they released an add-on that had 14 new crops, and some of them are made by crossbreeding other crops, and I think they're only somewhat telling you which ones are which. So they picked up this moment where this person was on the edge of retiring from the game and threw, you know, a whole bunch more stuff that she has to do on top of it.
Hooray, yes. Addiction.
And by she and someone I know, I am, of course, referring to my wife. Sorry, honey.
Hi, Jeff's wife.
Hi.
Actually, as Mark knows, log on to my Facebook account from time to time to harvest my crops for me so that she can get the bushels. And that's why Mark has talked to her several times. All right. My fails.
Yeah. We're best as best friends.
That's not weird right at all.
Yeah. My first fail is one that is... my first fail is actually the one I found out today, which is a fail to Google Docs. I had, for my Shadowrun character, a piece of background fiction for the character written, which was very mature. And I think I'd emailed the link to a couple of people, and I had posted on the Fear of the Boot forums on the Tell Me About Your Character thread that doc along with several other docs. And I went on there today because it came up in conversation, and Google Docs has flagged the document as inappropriate and said I can no longer share it. I haven't tested it with person-to-person sharing and emailing, but the way the comment is written, I'm an old-school libertarian right now. Censorship in any form bugs the crap out of me, and the fact that it's Google doing this, which is the same company that keeps Google Health, raises really, really big privacy concerns. I gotta say, it creeps me out. The other fail I have is going to be a lot more unpopular fail. It's actually going to go, I think, to the indie RPG movement, because
I'm going to kill you.
They are going to kill me. I noticed that I no longer have any radar almost at all of what new game is coming out. I mean, you know, this is something that they did on, they mentioned on Fear the Boot a couple weeks ago on one of their episodes. Harry Dresden, the game, the Dresden Files game, last year that was their big, the RPG world's big to do. And in years before that, usually there have been, like, you know, Dragon Age, the pen and paper RPG from Green Ronin. It just seems like as the indie RPG movement has grown, there seems to be no game that can command this kind of word of mouth, word of advertising awareness. Now, I can respect that because that means that better, more experimental concepts are getting through to the gamers, but I think the sheer lack of publicity might be shutting out, you know, general awareness of RPGs in general. It's getting to be kind of depressing almost that, you know, D&D 4th Ed, D&D Red Box, or whatever the new box is, I forget. Even that doesn't seem like it's really being Maybe it's separation from me and the media that, you know, goes around this, you know, Dragon, all the, a lot of the general gaming magazines have folded. There's no more Scry, I don't think. There's no, certainly no more Inquest, stuff like that. It seems like a lot of the magazines are becoming house organs I have no interest in reading. But it just seems like RPG awareness is waning due to the no publicity stance of indie RPG companies, that they're relying on word of mouth to their fans, and those fans, you know, they find that one group that likes this one specific indie RPG that caters to a very specific crowd, and it stops. So I realized, maybe the fails to myself, but I realized I don't have any kind of awareness of what's going on in the RPG publishing industry these days. And I follow several RSS feeds on Google Reader. And, you know, they talk about maybe a new book for Shadowrun or something like that. But nothing's commanding the attention except for the diehard fans for each individual system, because they're just doing splat books. Yeah. So that's my fails.
Now, Jeff, and I have to ask you something. How much of that do you honestly think that most of the new indie RPGs that are coming out are fan things? Either they're directly named after, or they're, you know, like, oh, I want to make a fan thing for Dot Hack, so I'm gonna name it like Dot Break
Point Hack
or something. But that they're direct fan things, and yes, and they look at those with the same disdain and horror as they do regular fan fiction.
To some extent. I mean, now, well, that's the thing, because a couple of years ago, I was hearing about stuff like Don't Rest Your Head and Penny for My Thoughts and Dread. They were indie games that still seemed to capture the attention. I mean, for instance, at this year's Fear the Con, there, I think, will still be about 2 to 4 Dread games. I know there's at least one Don't Rest Your Head game, and I think I've heard there may be a Penny for Your Thoughts game. These, you know, indie, maybe it could just be these indie titles take longer to get to the awareness, but does that mean that last year, as these three, you know, bigger named experimental games are coming to the forefront, the indie developers faded back? I don't know. It's weird to be in a quiet room, it seems like.
Yeah, it's almost as if there is that deep welling fear that I can't compete with that, so why should I even bother advertising against it?
Yeah, I suppose, but it seems like now that's kind of a moot point because no one's competing at all. Anyway, that's my fails. It shouldn't be a big point. It was just, that's what's on my mind.
Okie dokie, I think that clears up everything. So if you want to contact the podcast as a whole, it's gamingasylumpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to contact an individual host, I'm gamingasylummichael@gmail.com.
I'm gamerinterface@gmail.com.
And I'm trapchest@gmail.com.
And we also, of course, have our iTunes feed. You can leave us a comment. 5-star rating, hint, hint. Or you can go to our...
I'll take a 1-star rating as long as you tell us why.
Yeah, I honestly will too. Don't just be a ranting internet jerk. Because I will hunt you down. You think I'm joking, Larry.
Don't even get me started on
Larry,
on
you think
comments.
I'm joking. I will hunt you down. I just hope there's someone named Larry who's really freaking out right now.
I believe that takes this episode of The Gaming Asylum to its right and proper conclusion.
It does, but quick note. We had gamingasylumpodcast.blogspot.com. We are now posting blogs, or at least I am. Go read those.
I have one in the works.
And he will soon. Post some soon. So go read
Beat
those.
Beat that address
because awesome.
It was kind of garbled.
GamingAsylumPodcast.blogspot.com because I'm too cheap to buy a URL.
Yeah, that's a good URL. It's just a long one.
Yes. And anyone
Maybe
else
for your birthday.
That was 2 weeks ago, buddy.
Well, happy.
Yes, happy birthday.
Right. Editing that out. Alright, well, see you, listener.
I refer to listeners past and future present. We thank you for listening, and we hope you tuned in to next show.
Bye. Gaming Asylum is owned by Michael Burdick. Under the Creative Commons license, it's licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0.